But then my mom died when I was 23. She had a brain aneurysm, so it was really sudden. She was fine one minute and gone the next. And then 3 years to the day that my mom died, my 26-year-old husband died. And so now I'm a widow. I don't have my mom. I'm 26, and I'm supposed to be a therapist who helps other people deal with their problems. But I was like, oh, like, how do I get through this?
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jessie LeBeau.
Well, here we are. I'm so excited. First off, I feel like before I even say who you are and make the announcement, these books look amazing. So how many books do you have? And also, what are the other plaques? Let's get right to the good stuff.
So I have book number 6, which is the purple one that will hit the shelves later this year. And they're all about 13 things mentally strong people, parents, women, kids, couples don't do. And the plaques belong to my producer. He's my podcast producer, but in his spare time, he records albums with people like Mark Anthony and Pharrell Williams and lots
Never
of
heard of them.
People. So, right? So he gets all these cool plaques. So he kindly lets me put my books on the same shelf as his plaques.
That is, I feel like it completes it. One on either side, it kind of anchors it. It's very balanced. I love it. And you said he's off having a fun time right now at the Latin Grammys. So
he's at the Latin Grammys. He has 16 Grammys. So he's a,
what a guy.
Whatever album he records seems to be gold. So he every year gets to go off and get more Grammys.
Wait, so how do you meet someone like that?
So I was recording my audiobook, The 13 Things Mentally Strong Women Don't Do. And I live in the Florida Keys where we don't have a lot of professional studios. So the closest place they could find was in Miami, happened to be called Criteria Studios or the Hit Factory, where all these legendary songs have been recorded over the years, like the Eagles recorded Hotel California there.
Oh.
And my audio engineer, I knew he had a Grammy with Snoop Dogg before I met him. And I thought, oh, now he has to listen to me read a women's book for 5 days. But we hit it off, became great friends. And so when I decided to do a podcast and I needed an audio engineer, I said, what do you think? And he gratefully agreed to be the producer of a mental health podcast.
Well, you know, as I'm thinking about it, like you're like, you know, it's probably less cool than Snoop Dogg, but it's probably a lot easier gig because you're not having to deal with the personality. And, you know, Snoop's got a lot of extracurricular activities that you may not want to ingest, you know. So for you, you could just sit down and have a more normal conversation and maybe work and learn something when it comes to his mental strength.
That's it, exactly. And he says, you know, that like the superstars, a lot of them work like wild hours, overnight hours, 3 days in a row and no time off. And my schedule is much more predictable.
Yeah, a little bit more understandable. So everyone, we're here with the wonderful, the amazing, and can you correct me if I get this wrong, but it's a licensed clinical social worker.
You got it.
Is this okay? See, I'm good. I'm good at this. Amy Morin, we're so excited to have you here. And which was the first book out of all these ones that you did that started off this empire that you're building?
So 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do was the first book that came out in 2014.
Wow. And what was for you the passion behind that? What made you want to put this out into the world? I know how much time and energy it takes to write a book, rewrite, deal with editors and all those things. And my mom was a school teacher and it was always good writing is rewriting. So you went through the process once and you're like, you know what? I want to do it again. So what was the thing that had that passion for you behind this topic?
So actually, you know, in the beginning, I didn't want to write a book at all. It was an article that went viral. And 50 million people read it. So a literary agent called and said, you should write a book. I didn't even know what a literary agent was. I had no intentions of writing a book. I wrote the article because of my own pain. I was in probably the worst day of my life, the worst, darkest moments of my life. I wrote a letter to myself called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, and then got invited to write a book. Kind of didn't know what I was getting into. I was a social worker in rural Maine, had no idea how to write a book, never met anybody who had written a book. All I knew was Stephen King lived about 45 minutes away. Other than that, knew nothing about books.
It's possible. You got a local
right?
Latin.
And so wrote the first one and then thought, okay, I got to be a therapist who wrote a book. That's kind of cool. And because the article had gotten 50 million views, my publisher had big hopes for the book when it came out. And, you know, 50 million people did not buy the book. So initially we thought, well, that's good. But then about a year and a half after the book came out, I started hitting bestseller lists, which is kind of rare. Normally, you don't hit a bestseller list a year and a half later, but hit the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, bestseller list. And then I just thought, well, might as well take a chance and see, maybe I can write a second book. And then it's just led to one book after another. And that's why book six is coming out later this year.
So exciting. And the couples need that one. So do you know, did you figure out, does anyone know what made it all of a sudden kind of resurface a year later, 2 years later, to get such a reception from people and hit the bestsellers list?
Yeah, I got some unexpected press from Rush Limbaugh, who on Monday said, we're going to talk about the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. And then he never got to it that day. So then on Tuesday, he said, today, we're going to get to it. The 13 things mentally strong people don't do. He still never got to it. That happened Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. He didn't actually get to it till Friday. By the time he got to it on Friday, it had sold out of every bookstore. And because it was a year later after my book had already hit the shelves, like most bookstores like Barnes and Noble only had one or two physical copies of the book. And so I was fortunate that a lot of people then started buying the ebook. Like it sold out on Amazon, it sold out everywhere, but they started buying the ebook and the audiobook, which counts for some bestsellers lists like USA Today and Wall Street Journal. And then since then, we've had some other just like random press opportunities that will occasionally happen where a big celebrity pushes it on social media and boom, you hit the bestsellers list again.
Yeah, that's so did he, okay, when Rush Limbaugh does that and he's teasing it, was he referring specifically to your book in your name, or did he just take the title of your book and be like, we're going to talk about this topic tomorrow? Or he was saying like, you were specifically mentioned, I assume.
Yeah, he had specifically mentioned my article when the article came out. And then a year and a half later, he specifically mentioned my book. And so an old friend from high school texted me and said, Rush Limbaugh is talking about you. And I was like, oh, it must be a replay because he talked about my article, you know, a year and a half ago. They're like, no, he's talking about you today, about your book. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
And then people went and Googled it because he never got to it.
But it was almost the best thing that could have happened is him just, it's amazing the power when these people have these type of platforms. Now, when you put a book out there, Rush Limbaugh is a kind of one, I don't want to say the original polarizing figure, but I feel like he's just like most people that are successful. Half the people love him, half of the people hate them. Does that cause stress or difficult for you? Or are you only kind of reaping the benefits of the people who are interested in a positive way in your work going and getting the book? Did it cause any problems in any ways? Because there are a lot of people that don't like them just as much as people that do love them.
Correct. So I was a social worker in rural Maine. And so I remember somebody saying to me, like, him reading your name better be really good for your career as an author, because it might not be the greatest for your career as a social worker.
Yeah.
And and so there was, and I've had other people be like, I would never want him to mention my name. But the truth is, like, I'm happy to have people who want to promote my book, like, and it's okay. And I can separate different people's, you know, opinions, ideas, and I don't have to endorse everything that they do for them to endorse my book. Goodness, no.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. People are so afraid, especially these days. Like, I did a podcast with Ted Nugent over the pandemic, and you know, I love him. I love the family because they liked my grandfather because he was a bow and arrow hunter. So like the politics, all that stuff and the music, I never listened to any of it, to be honest, until after the relationship was formed or whatever. And it's still not my cup of tea, but people love it, I know. But it was like, I sat on it for like a year because I'm like, I don't know like how this is going to be received. And it was like you said, everyone needs to hear, or maybe you didn't say it, I'm saying it now, but everyone, in my opinion, needs to hear your message that you have in that book, whether they're what side, what their beliefs are, what they look like, where they live in the world. And so I love that attitude. And I think it's such a better thing when people can come together and look at like, yeah, we all don't agree on most things. And if you agree with someone on everything, then you probably aren't thinking too much for yourself. So what an interesting, I didn't expect it to take that turn. So I want to ask, can we go back and hear the Amy story of, you said you went through a really difficult time and that's what kind of spurred this on for you. What what was your childhood like, and what was this experience that led you to have this moment that it looks like was a light bulb moment for you to inspire and help other people?
Yeah, so my childhood was good. I grew up in rural Maine with both my parents and a sister, and life was great. I went to college and thought, yeah, I'm going to be a therapist. Amazing. Got a job. Like, life was awesome. And but then my mom died when I was 23. She had a brain aneurysm, so it was really sudden. She was fine one minute and gone the next. And then 3 years to the day that my mom died, my 26-year-old husband died. And so now I'm a widow. I don't have my mom. I'm 26, and I'm supposed to be a therapist who helps other people deal with their problems. But I was like, oh, like, how do I get through this? And then one of the biggest problems, like practical problems I faced when my husband died, was I didn't have enough money to pay my bills as a therapist. We didn't earn a ton of money, and you can't really work overtime. Like, you can't be an effective therapist 100 hours a week. And I lived in a rural area where there weren't a lot of jobs. So writing actually became my side hustle, is because I could write freelance articles in the evenings and on the weekends. And if I felt up to it, I could do it, because I didn't want to move. I thought, I've lost so much. The last thing I want to do right now is like lose my house. So if I could make $600 a month writing articles, then I could keep my house, is what I had come up with. And so I was writing for mostly content mills who paid $15 to $25 an article.
Wow.
But I was able to keep my house because of that, and went on and did a few other like side hustles over the years to try to generate some income. But it took years to really pull myself out of that and figure out, how do I still be a therapist and how do I still mend my broken heart at the same time? And a few years later, I found love. I got remarried and I was ready to move. We decided to sell that house and I got to do it by choice. But like, just as we were moving into our new house, starting our new life, we got news that my father-in-law had terminal cancer. And I just remember thinking, like, this isn't fair. Like, I just spent all these years grieving, and now I had this really close relationship with my father-in-law, and I'm about to lose him too. And it was then that I wrote a letter to myself about what mentally strong people don't do. I was like, okay, no matter what, right now, just don't do these things, and somehow you'll get through it. You'll feel okay. And I put the list in my pocket, and I would read it over every day, like, just get through the day, Amy, if you can just don't do these things. And then I thought, well, if it helps me, maybe it will help somebody else. So I put it online. I got paid $15 for it, and I thought that was it. Walked away from the computer and never imagined that 50 million people would read it, because it wasn't meant to be public. And initially, it didn't share the backstory. It was like pretty much just the list of the 13 things. And it wasn't until later, like, a literary agent was one of the people that read it, and she said, you should write a book. And I said, well, there's a story behind it, but nobody knows the story. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I was on, there's video footage of me out there, like within a couple weeks of publishing the article, I was on Forbes, like doing a video interview, and Fox News and CNN in Mexico called, and MTV in Finland. And I was just like, oh, I just know these things. And I didn't really share the backstory until the next year when the book came out, as I came to the conclusion of perhaps I should share that I didn't write this list just because I mastered it, but I wrote it because I actually struggled with all of these things too.
And when you shared the backstory, do you feel like it became so much more powerful, and the response that you got was even more people coming to you, how they could relate, or it touched their heart, or they connected with it more?
I did. I was afraid I would lose credibility as a therapist if I told people, like, yeah, hey, guess what? I'm struggling with all this stuff.
Yeah.
So I was really scared. I didn't want to lose my job as a therapist. I didn't want to. I didn't want it to affect my therapy career, because I didn't think I had a career being an author at the time. But once I started sharing and making my story public, yeah, I felt like it. People then thought, oh, okay, then I'm not alone if I struggle with these things too. And if I struggle with any of these things, it doesn't mean it means I have some things I can work on. So I do feel like people found it to be more relatable once they knew the backstory.
Yeah. I've seen that same thing as a speaker, where initially a lot of times you go out there and you just want to like list all your accomplishments to be like, no, like, I'm worthy of listening to, like, to trust me, like, I'm qualified, and you're kind of compensating. And the part that they then come up to you afterwards about is the part when you start sharing like, oh no, like I was bullied or I felt like an underdog. The things that you feel like don't give you that credibility is actually the thing that shares your humanity. So that's why I asked the question, and that's cool to see that you saw that too.
Yeah, that's a tough line, right? Because you want to come across with some expertise, but at the same time, we still struggle with certain things too. And there's that fine line of how do I acknowledge that I struggle with this, but perhaps I also have something that can be of value to other people.
Yeah, it's, man, that is so true and so powerful. I was wondering from your experience going through such immense and unexpected loss twice in a short amount of time, and then this third situation, do you feel like you were able to be stronger and help your husband through that situation because of what you went through before? And I'm just trying to see like the bright side and like the positive of that situation. Cause it's like, why, like you said, this isn't fair. These things happen in life that we just can't imagine. And it's terrible too, when it's kids, because so often like your situation, those things were completely out of your control. It wasn't cause you made a bad decision. It wasn't, you know, something where you could like be like, oh man, if only I'd done this. It's like, this is just an act of God. Did it help you, comfort and I guess process that with your husband?
Yeah, I guess when we knew that my father-in-law's time was fairly limited, it was one of those, like, I knew what was coming. When I lost my mother, it was unexpected. When I lost my first husband, it was completely unexpected as well. So then to know that it was coming, it was like this different kind of dread of, oh, you know, I don't want to go through it, but I didn't have a choice. But also knew what it was like to lose a parent. So then to know, all right, I knew what my husband and his family are going to go through. I knew what his mom was going to be about to face too. So it certainly helped there. And there were definitely other things, you know, positive things that came out of it in terms of, well, I've conquered my fear of public speaking. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have spoken in front of two people, let alone get on a big stage. Or small things that used to stress me out, like, hey, not a problem anymore. I can keep life in perspective. And I think it does help me to like appreciate the good times in life. I think when you've really been at the bottom of the barrel, then like when something good happens, you can really fully embrace the joy that comes with it as well.
I love that. I feel like so often in our lives, in even in my own life, going through these difficult situations, it's obviously, it sucks. It's hard. It's not fair. But did you find, as being a therapist, that you're going through this tremendous pain at home, but then you're going out and you're seeing other people who are also going through maybe just as much pain, if not more, and they have tough home life. And now you're pouring your energy into helping them. Did that help you in your healing process and during that time?
It did, because it also just reminded me that even though my therapy clients were dealing with completely different scenarios, different problems, like pain is pain. We all experience it, and it might be to different intensities or over different things, but it's universal. And even though I was in immense pain for a long time, I felt like still being able to sit with people who were in pain too, and that they talked to me and they opened up and they shared so much with me, like what an honor that was to be able to sit with them in those moments. And of course, 95% of my therapy clients had no idea what had happened. I live in a small town. So then I took a couple months off from work when my husband passed away. So a couple of my therapy clients knew because they figured it out. Most of them didn't, but I didn't have to share that with them in order for them, I think, to also get something out of just being there and having somebody who sits with you in pain and who doesn't run away, but who can tolerate that and still say, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, it's almost like just this blessing of like, okay, I get to do this thing for a job where I go and I pour into other people. And in return, that makes me feel fulfilled. That's one of the biggest things with parents and kids that we work with, is if we can shift you from being someone who has this mindset of like, I'm someone who needs help, to I'm someone that helps other people. To me, that's like mental strength. And so that's why I was so excited to talk to you today about some of these things. So before I kind of want to shift to the parent and teen, because you have a book on that. And that's obviously something that we share in common. One of the biggest things before you can be a good parent is you just have to be a good human, and you have to help yourself, right? Is there a few things from the first book that you could touch on? We don't maybe do all 13 of them, but a couple ones that you would suggest for people to be mentally more capable in their lives, so that pours over to their kids who are looking up to them and mirroring them and all those things. How can we become mentally stronger? And I'm asking for a friend, and by a friend, I mean myself.
Right, exactly. I would say some of the most important ones would be, don't feel sorry for yourself. And your kids are watching you when you go through hard times, and it's okay to be sad, and we need to teach them healthy coping skills for sadness. But what's different is when we like think, oh, my life will never get any better. There's nothing I can do. People like us don't get ahead. When we send those messages to kids, it teaches them to get stuck in a victim mentality too. So we want to show them like, no, I am in pain or I am struggling, but here's how I'm going to cope with it in a healthy way. Because otherwise, so many kids I work with are like, no, my parents never get sad. Because their parents don't ever show sadness.
Yeah.
You know, we see anger and happiness and then blah, but nothing really in between. So it's okay to teach kids about those feelings. And another one would be to not give up after failure. So often we don't even tell kids when we fail, right? And like, you don't want to tell your kid, I applied for a promotion and I didn't get it, because we don't want our kids to know that about us. But on the other hand, it's important for our kids to know that we were brave enough to try. Even if we didn't make it, that like, yeah, I tried, it didn't work out, and here's what I'm going to do about it. So that we're not at all embarrassed to fail, or we don't feel like we have to hide failure, but instead we can learn from it.
I love those ones. And that's a big one today that you see in the world, is there's almost like a currency in being a victim. And especially with teenagers, it's like, I don't want to look like I'm trying, you know, the too cool for school. Like if I out for the cheerleading team and I don't make it, then people can make fun of me. But if I just don't try ever, then they can't make fun of me for these things. But this dirty secret is they're still going to find something else to make fun of you for. So you might as well go for the thing. So keep going. Don't give up. And I would argue that the people that are the most successful in life are the ones that probably failed the most and just kept going. So I love that. Okay. One more. You got one more on mental toughness for us?
Yeah. I'd say don't give away your power. Like how often do we say like, oh, my boss makes me work late. But no, your boss doesn't make you work late. It's a choice. And there could be a consequence if you don't do it. But telling your kids like, you know, I don't want to work late tonight, but if I don't, my boss is going to be angry. So I'm going to choose to do it. Or when we blame other people, like that relative who maybe you say, you know, they ruined the party, or they make me feel bad about myself. We don't want to teach kids like other people have the power to do that. No, you're in control of how you think, how you feel, and how you behave. And you want to empower yourself and make it clear to your kids, like, these are our choices. Like, I don't have to go to the grocery store. I get to go to the grocery store today, or I'm choosing to do that.
Yeah.
Or I don't have to, you know, this person didn't waste my time. I allowed them to take up a lot of my time. Those slight changes in language make a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big one. And another one that I see people struggling with so much when it comes to it. The other way is like taking 100% responsibility, right? For every aspect of your life, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's so much easier just to point the finger than to be like, no, this is up to me. Maybe I don't need to spend time around this person, or I need to change my career, or I need to have better boundaries with these things. So I love that one too. So I have a question for you. When it comes to parenting, particularly with teens, do you feel like it's harder to be a parent today than it was, say, 20 years ago?
You know, I think so, because we don't like have a script for how do you deal with cell phone use, or how do you deal with social media, password. Things are evolving so much faster than they were. And there's certain things that we know aren't good for kids. Like we know they shouldn't be sitting on the couch and watching TV and playing video games all the time. Yet we just went through the pandemic where what did we ask them to do? Sit and stare at your screens all day, right? So I think for those reasons, there's a lot of things that where this generation is sort of a guinea pig on, because no other generation has experienced it. So parents don't have a good guide. There are no long-term studies on what happens to kids who grow up with digital devices in their hand. So we don't really know a lot of the things. And as it evolves, you know, more technology keeps advancing. So it's hard to keep up with it.
Yeah, there's just so many more things going on today. And if you're trying to be a responsible parent, which I think most people here listening are, and most people are, it's like, how do I keep up with the newest app and what's going on? My prediction is that you bring up cell phones and social media, is that it is going to be like a warning label like they have with cigarettes now. I just think it's destroying social skills, their kids developing brain. But what do I know? This is just a guy with an opinion that's never met Rush Limbaugh and never been shouted out by him. Do you have any opinions or thoughts on screen time, phones, and social media?
Yeah. And I'll say, I know it's easier said than done. In my therapy office, I'm going to talk to parents about limits and all of that. And then in my personal life, I was a foster parent for about 10 years and I had mostly teenage girls. So I know it's easy to be like, yeah, set an hour's time limit, but how do you really enforce that? Or what do you do? And then you have a kid, you know, so I know it's easier said than done. So with that disclaimer, but I do think it's important to try to make sure that we have plenty of screen-free days and times. And as you alluded to before with kids' social skills, there's a study that always gets me where they sent kids to camp. One half of the group went to camp for 2 weeks where they didn't have access to their digital devices. The other group just kept continuing to use them as normal. They tested the kids before they left on how good they were at reading other people's emotions. And then in 2 weeks, they tested them again. The kids, of course, that just kept playing with their phones, their skills stayed the same. The kids that went away to camp for 2 weeks, their ability to read other people's facial expressions and to understand their emotions skyrocketed. They got way better with just a 2 week break. And they weren't using emojis anymore. Instead, they were looking somebody in the eye and they were like, oh, that person looks like they feel sad, or that person is happy right now.
Yeah.
But there's something about spending all this time behind our screens that dumbs us down. It makes it much more difficult to read other people and to understand and to communicate and to socialize. So I think anytime we can implement screen-free times is really important. You might say on Saturdays, we're going to unplug and your kids are going to panic, but do you take them hiking in the woods someplace where they don't even have the option of using their phones? And suddenly it gets much easier. And to be careful of our own habits too, right? Like don't check your phone at the dinner table. Don't, when your kids are talking to you, resist the urge to pick up your phone, even if you hear a ding. Make sure that, you know, when we're at the movies or that we go places, that we can put our phones in our pockets and not look at them. And to call people out if in the middle of a conversation, somebody pulls out their phone, or you go to a restaurant and everybody's staring at their phone at the table. Be like, no, we're not doing this. Because, you know, the last thing you want is for your kids to miss out on life because they're staring at their phones. And I see this happen a lot where the family has gone on a trip somewhere and the kids are just texting the whole time and not really enjoying it. And plenty of adults are guilty of this, too. And instead of enjoying the moment. And I know sometimes we're like, oh, I'm taking pictures. Well, are you taking pictures because you want to share it on Instagram later? Yeah. Or are you really enjoying the moment? So I think all of those things are important things to teach kids.
Yeah, I need everyone to see how amazing my life is on vacation, right? All of these things. It's so funny. I'm thankful for social media in a lot of ways because it lets you see people's full-on mental illnesses. And you're like, oh, and sometimes I'll meet someone and I'm like, this is such a cool person. And then I'll go and see how they are on social media. And I'm like, oh man, what a bummer. I could never be friends with this person because you're mentally ill posting a selfie every day. Or, you know, it's interesting, but I love that you mentioned the thing about modeling it with the phone, because a lot of times it's so easy to talk the talk and be like, this is what I do as I say, not as I do. But it does seem like from every person I talk to, from personal experience, that it's really what you actually are doing instead of what you're saying. Do you find that to be the thing as well in your practice?
Certainly. The kids watch and learn so much more from what we do rather than what we say. Yeah. And I've had parents like in my therapy office with their teenager, and we're talking about the dangers of social media, and the parent's phone will ring and the parents will answer it. And they're like, well, it's for work, so this doesn't count, right?
Yeah. It's an email. Yeah.
Right, right. And I think a lot of us have been guilty of that, of thinking, you know, well, I'm multitasking, or I'm getting something done while I'm on my phone, or I can do this, you know, while my kids are next to me watching a movie, they don't really mind. Or But they do. They notice all of those little things. Or you're texting while you're driving, thinking, I'm just going to answer this quick text message. Like, no, your kids see all of this, and they're not going to, you're not going to be credible when you tell them not to use their phones all the time if we're doing it ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly an interesting world. Who thought this would be the thing that we'd be, you know,
right,
working through in 2023? And then the pandemic comes. And like you said, it affected me not being able to just smile at people and see them smile back when you go to Starbucks or wherever you're out and about. It like really affected my mood. And on the phone screen topic, just 2 days ago, I was walking here in the neighborhood, and school just got out. And so there was three kids walking about 50 feet apart from each other. And the first kid, he was the oldest, like probably like a senior boy in high school. So the biggest, head straight down on his phone. The next one was like a medium-sized girl, head straight down on the phone. And then the last one was a little boy, like probably sixth grade, head down. And it just saw, and it was like something out of like a cartoon. I'm like, man, this breaks my heart. People need to get out there, connect with people, live real life, and do it for yourself. Like you said, and not, oh, I'm on vacation, I'm taking pictures, but I just want everyone else to know. And I think that comes back to that whole caring too much about what other people think. So I'm curious from you, what are some of the things that you see in all these parents, all these families, all the feedback you get from your article, reaching 50 million people, your best-selling books? What are some of the biggest mistakes that parents are making, or issues that parents are coming to you about, and kind of what are those solutions that you offer up for them?
Sure. So one big one is parents taking responsibility for their kids' feelings. I think this is a bigger issue more now than ever, where parents feel like they're supposed to entertain their kids. If their kids are bored, they feel bad. Like, oh, I should do something to make sure my kids are entertained. Or their kids are sad, parents are worried that it reflects poorly on them, so I got to go cheer you up.
Yeah.
Or if kids are going through a tough time, parents want to fix it, which makes sense because we don't like to see kids struggle. But on the other hand, we're taking that opportunity away from kids to learn. And it's so important for kids to know, like, it's okay to be bored. You can be bored for a little while. Or it's okay to be sad. But what do you do with those sad feelings? And something I see in the office, we'll talk about the difference between thoughts, feelings, and behavior. And even a lot of the parents struggle with that. I'll say, like, what did you think about that? And they'll say, well, I was angry. Okay, well, anger is an emotion.
Yeah.
Or I'll say, you know, how did you feel when this happened? And they'll say, well, I thought he was a jerk. Well, that's a thought. And then, what did you do with that? Or they'll be like, you know, he has anger problems because he's hitting his sister. Well, that means he has an aggression problem. Like, it's okay to be angry, but what you do with those angry feelings is your behavior. So it's important to separate those things, send the message that your feelings are okay. And you can't always control the first thought that pops into your head. Those are our automatic thoughts, but you can control how you respond to them and whether you entertain them and whether you act on them. And then the behavioral piece, like, how does your behavior affect other people? How's it affecting your life? Is it making it better or worse sitting on the couch, say, scrolling through social media as opposed to going outside? And so I think it's really important for us to just make sure we're actively teaching those skills to kids, because I hear a lot of parents or teachers even say, well, kids are resilient. Well, they're not born resilient. Otherwise, we'd all be super resilient adults. They can be resilient, but we have to teach them skills. How do you deal with disappointment, rejection, embarrassment? And to normalize that we all have those struggles, that we all struggle. Nobody wants to feel those things, but what do you do when you feel them? So that'd be my first tip. Mm. Another big one is teaching kids to change their own thoughts. So a kid says, you know, gosh, I'm so terrified about this recital I have on Friday. Our first response is to be like, don't worry about it. You'll do great. And the kid walks away thinking either I'm an idiot for having these thoughts, or, you know, my mom or dad thinks I'm going to do well, but I don't. So therefore, there's something wrong with the way that I think. And then they become dependent on mom or dad to reassure them all the time. And I used to see this as a college professor, too. First year students were having to call mom and dad all the time to be like, is this okay? Or, you know, I have a test Friday. What do I do? We want to teach them to think for themselves. So to teach them, when your kid says, gosh, I'm really worried about this thing on Friday, either don't tell them their feelings are wrong by saying, don't worry about it. And don't tell them, you know, you're going to do great. Sit down and have a conversation like, okay, if you're worried about this, what can you do about it? Do you need to practice more? do you need to maybe color a picture? Because you can either solve the problem or solve how you feel about the problem. So maybe the problem is you're not prepared for the recital. Great. How do we practice between now and Friday? And what might that look like? If they're like, you know, I've been practicing all day, every day, I'm just nervous about it. Okay, well, then how can we cope with that? Maybe you practice a couple deep breathing strategies so when they get out on stage, they don't panic. Or you're like, all right, what do you do when you're worried? Maybe we'll color a picture, depending on how old they are. But really helping kids figure those things out so that when you're not right there to tell them, don't worry about it, honey, then they know, all right, I am worried about it, and here's what I can do about it.
Dude, this is so good. I'm loving every bit of this. And I especially, our mantra is attitude is everything. And so a lot of times I'll hear that message throughout people's talks, speeches, interviews like this. And it's kind of saying the same thing, just wording it a little bit different way. Like you said, you can't control really what's happening to you, but you can control how you respond. And I think that's such a powerful thing. And then like you're saying with the thoughts, like you are what you think. And that's what scares me the most about this thing is it's literally just distracting you and numbing you out so you aren't thinking. And if you aren't in control of like, all right, I'm just going to just not have to think and see what other people are doing all the time, then that's not going to be a healthy or good thing. So it does feel like that coddling of the American mind, right? And that these parents, I've heard it called concierge parents. Like you said, they have to entertain them all the time. All right, well, we'll take you here. We're running you this. Like, dude, these kids' schedules today is they have sports, they have school, they have coaches, they got their therapy session. It's like sometimes I hear these things and I'm like, who are you? Like Barack Obama Jr.? Like,
right.
Like you have a crazier schedule. Their favorite food is sushi. Getting down another path here. But what do you think? Why do you think so many parents are feeling the pressure to just absolutely be a concierge type of parent? Is it something that they feel like they didn't have that growing up as a kid? They're compensating, but that definitely this mental weakening. That's why I love your message so much. But why do you think that parents are kind of getting caught in this trap?
A couple of reasons. I think when I was a kid, if I forgot my homework, like the world didn't end because guess what? Everybody in their class forgot the homework sometimes.
Yeah.
And then like the pendulum kind of swung to the other direction where like if a kid forgot their homework, parents were driving it to the school within 5 minutes because they didn't want their kid to fall behind. And so I think parents are feeling a lot of that pressure, like, all right, the bar has been lifted and I now have to help make sure my kid keeps up. And I think a lot of parents feel like it's a personal reflection on themselves. If your kid is a C student, then like, oh, you know, like, am I doing something wrong to not make them an A student? Or if my kid, it looks like they may not get into the best college that they want to go to. Does that mean I failed them somehow? And I want to give my kids the very best opportunities and everything I can. And I don't want them to fall behind anybody else. And our kids, of course, pick up on that, too. They're like, oh, you know, you have to have 17 activities after school to make sure that looks good on your transcript, in addition to being a straight A student.
Yeah.
And I think that mentality really just forces everyone to get caught up in this achievement culture of like, the more you achieve, the better you are. And the better you are, then the more things you can achieve later on in life. And it's this vicious cycle. Like nobody's ever like, whoo, I achieved enough, or I'm still a good person, even though I failed that test, or even though I'm struggling or I didn't make the basketball team, like that's okay. Instead, I just hear so much. And I'm hearing, I have a friend who's a teacher who called me yesterday. He's a track coach. And he said, all of these kids, especially the girls, are crying before the track meets start because they're afraid they aren't going to do good enough. And he said, what do I do? And I said, do you think the pressure's coming from the parents? And he said, not all of them. He said, a lot of them, I think, are just worried about embarrassing themselves, or they're worried about failing somebody. They don't even know who they're worried about failing. And because of that, he said, it's like paralyzing them. They're really struggling to function sometimes because they're so afraid of not living up to some sort of set of expectations that many of them have created for themselves.
Man, I've become like baseball uncle. I go to all these baseball games, my 12-year-old nephew, and it is like, we sit back and we watch and these kids are crying. And like, we pointed out, you know, after the game, so what'd you think of that? You know, your five teammates cried today when they made a mistake or did something. Like, what do you think's going on there? And then it's a conversation of like, hey, you know, you get to go home. You're still going to get In-N-Out Burger afterwards. The world didn't end. Like, it's just baseball. And you guys are 12 years old. It's not that serious. But in their world, it's everything to them. And it's kind of helping them find that that perspective when it comes to that stuff. But I see that so much in sports and this pressure. And it's really, really fascinating to me to see kind of how people are navigating that. Do you think most parents are afraid to let their kids fail? And why is it important, in your opinion, if you agree with this, for them to learn how to fail?
I do think a lot of parents are worried about letting their kids fail. We don't want to see our kids in pain, and failure is painful. So we try to save them from that. And I think another piece of it too is when it comes to parents trying to live vicariously through their kids, right?
Yes.
The parents who didn't make the team or who didn't do as well, or who thought, you know, I could have been more successful if my parents had been there for me. If I hadn't been a latchkey kid back in the day, then maybe I could have done better. And we know from the research, like, actually, that's really healing for the parent. The parent that never made the football team, and you start raising a football star, guess what? That's really good for you. Yeah, unfortunately, it's really bad for your kids. Yeah. And the research will show that all day long, that for parents, it's quite healing to go back and do this thing and kind of work through these unhealed emotional wounds from when you were 15. But putting that pressure on your kids and trying to make them live the life you wish you had is quite damaging. So I think it's important for parents to be aware of that. Like, what were my unmet childhood needs, my unmet dreams, maybe things I wished I had been able to do? And how do I make sure that I'm not living vicariously through my kids in order to heal myself? And you need to go heal that on your own, whether you go see a therapist or you work through some things without using your kid to do it. And then on the other hand, yeah, knowing this is going to be painful and it's going to be uncomfortable, but I'd rather let my kids fail when they're under my roof and they get practice at getting good at failing and then recovering, rather than waiting till they're 25 and something terrible happens, they fail and they don't know what to do then. And at least now you can make sure that they're using healthy coping strategies. And when they aren't, you step in and you teach them something else, or you get them help if they need it, rather than waiting till they're 25 and they turn to things you really don't want them to turn to help cope with those uncomfortable feelings.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's all too common with this living vicariously through your kids. I see that one a lot too. And it is just a fascinating kind of phenomenon to watch. Like, hey, I don't want to see them. It's like the best of intentions. You know, the intentions are there, but what they're actually doing is hurting more than it's helping. And we want to prepare them for the road ahead and not run around and like bubble wrap everything. And because that's not realistic. Your job as a parent is to get them so they can stand on their own two feet, handle anything life throws at them, and be able to do that with their own grit and resilience. So I love all the things that you're teaching. I'm like so on board. What's one more thing if a parent wants to help their child be mentally stronger to handle any obstacle that life throws at them? What would be one of the 13 that we haven't touched on that you would think might be timely for today's parent?
I would say not to protect them from pain at all costs. Mm-hmm. So we know, again, that you don't want to throw your child to the wolves, but on the other hand, kids need the opportunity to deal with some things on their own or some things with your support. And I see a lot of well-intentioned parents who try to hide certain things from their kids. And an example was, I had a kid who came into my therapy office and she had incredible anxiety, but her anxiety had gotten worse over time. And the parents were kind of like, we don't know what's going on, why she's doing worse. And it took a while to figure it out. But one day she says to me, I overheard my parents talking and my dad has diabetes. And they said, oh, what do you know about that? And she said, you die from it. Obviously, that's why it's called diabetes.
Oh, jeez.
And this poor kid had spent the last few weeks like convinced her dad was about to die at any given moment. And it was the parents who tried to protect her from this. But because they didn't give her any information, the story she told herself was way worse than it actually was. And that happens a lot, that our attempts to shield kids backfires in some really strange ways. So it's okay to let your kids experience some painful experience, whether it's like we discussed before with failure, or it's kind of knowing the truth, or letting them grieve. I don't know how many parents I've had come in my office and they told the kids, you know, Fluffy ran away, but Fluffy actually was sick and had to go to the vet and has been put down. Mm. And then they were like, we don't know what to do. You know, 3 weeks later, we're like, Fluffy's still on vacation. Now what do we do?
Oh, jeez.
And like, it's okay to let you, you know, and I get it. I get it that so many parents want to protect their kids from being sad. Or even when it comes to divorce too, that parents try to stay together for the sake of the kids. And ultimately it's not good for anybody, including the kids, but they're like, we don't want our kids to be sad. But again, we need to let our kids feel those feelings. And the best time to do it's when they live under your roof and you can be there to help them through it.
Yeah. So how does a parent know when is enough pain or failure for them to experience? And when it's like, okay, this is a little bit too heavy and we need to intervene. And I feel like it's the same thing too, when it comes to like self-harm or the ideation around that of like, I don't know when to jump in and intervene or when to let them kind of foster that independence. Do you have any guidance for kind of doing that balancing act?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's tough. And especially you get into teenagers and they're kind of moody and they're weird anyway. And suddenly, you know, and it's not unusual for them to spend more time in their room than usual, those sorts of things. But basically, our rule is if it lasts more than 2 weeks, if it's interfering with daily functioning, if your kid has lost their appetite, their grades are going down, they're struggling to sleep, or maybe they're sleeping all the time, if they have lost interest in spending time with friends or doing fun things and you can't draw them out, you invite them to go do something that they would normally like to do and they're saying no, any of those things, and if it's lasting more than a couple of weeks, definitely call the pediatrician, call a therapist, just to get them checked out. We know things like depression, anxiety disorders are super common in the teenage years, but other things can crop up too. And it might be, ADHD sometimes goes undiagnosed. Sometimes kids have bipolar and it just goes undiagnosed for years. So definitely get them checked out. Sometimes a handful of therapy sessions can really help kids get back on track. Sometimes it's just a matter of family therapy. Some kids don't want to go to therapy. It's the last thing they'd want to do. So if you have a teenager who won't go for yourself. I have plenty of clients over the years where I never actually met the teen. I met the parents.
Yeah.
And we worked on how do you become a coach for your kids at home. So if your kid doesn't want to come in, that's okay. But here's what you can do, because you see them all day, every day anyway. They go to see a therapist only for an hour a week. They can make an impact. But if you teach the parents what to do, like, you can make a huge impact because you see them so much more.
Yeah. Well, speaking of therapy, people can come to you for that. Do you do it virtually or only in person?
At the moment, I do a little bit of both. Since I live on a sailboat, I do a lot more virtual.
So what we're going to, I love that. We're going to talk more about that. So people can come and find you at your website, amymorinlcsw.com.
Correct.
Okay. And of course, check out your new and latest book. It's going to be a big hit. And if they pre-order it now, which they can find on your website before December 26th, they can also get a free month of BetterHelp. Is that right?
Yes, they get a free month of therapy at BetterHelp, which is online therapy with licensed therapists in every state and all over the world.
So awesome. Well, I just love everything that you're doing. These books are all so exciting. I need to go and read them. I have not done all of them yet. And the new one is about couples, though. Can you give
Correct.
Us like a 30-second little just teaser on it?
Sure. So it's all about how do you become the strongest version of yourself, but also how do you motivate your partner? How do you inspire them? And what do you do if your partner doesn't want to change, but how can the two of you really figure out how do we become the best humans that we can together as a couple? And when you do that, you can accomplish some pretty incredible things.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you're doing amazing work. It is a much needed message. There's a lot of people hurting out there. If anyone's watching or listening to this right now, just know that you are not alone. There are other people out there going through it just like you. And there's people like Amy out there that are here to help. And I do want to say, you shared something earlier that really touched my heart. And I just know that your mother is so proud of everything that you accomplished. And she's looking down and watching right now. So on behalf of everyone, we're all so proud of you. And I want to just thank you for your work. And last, if I can, if you were to jump in a time machine and go back in time, you're going to have your first kids. coming out and you're going to give yourself one piece of parenting advice, could be mental fortitude related or anything, what would that one thing be?
That there's no perfect parent, and that the research shows you just have to be a good enough parent. And every mistake that you make is actually an opportunity to then teach your kids how to recover from a mistake. So don't put the pressure on yourself that you have to be perfect all the time, because you won't be. You'll make mistakes, but those are opportunities for you as well as your kids.
It sounds like you said attitude is everything. I might be a little biased, but that's what I heard. Amy, thank you so much. I'm so excited for everyone to check you out, and they can go to that website. We'll link it up below, and we'll be talking and have fun. Where's your next sale trip? Are you going anywhere?
I'm probably later today. I'm just going to go around the corner and go swimming. So
not a bad life. Awesome. We'll catch you next time. See you later, everybody.
Thank you.